Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Researchers from Spain and the U.S. last month published the results of a study about the effectiveness of the fitness trend known as muscle confusion. The theory is that by mixing up your workouts with unfamiliar exercises from day to day, your body is forced to adapt in ways that boost strength and avoid plateaus. New York Times Wellness Blog columnist Gretchen Reynolds recently wrote about the study. Welcome back, Gretchen.
Thanks very much for having me.
So I subscribe to the muscle confusion thing, and I think it's more for the reasons that they discovered in the study than it is for any actual, because, I mean, it's really impossible to make much of a headway on my body anymore. But how did researchers conduct the study?
Well, first I should start by saying muscle confusion for people out there who've never heard the term probably sounds like a pejorative. Sounds like it should be something that you
wouldn't want to avoid. Yeah.
But in fact, there is a theory, and there are a number of fitness programs, some of them very, very popular, that are built around this idea that if you keep changing the routine, if you're particularly this is for weight training essentially, if you keep changing what you are doing, your muscles, because they will be confused, will keep responding in wholly new ways, and you will get more of a sort of bang from your workout than if you do the same thing every day, even if you are lifting the same amount of weight. So the idea is confusing muscles is good. You'll get more out of your time in the gym if your muscles are discombobulated than if they're essentially bored. And so that sounds actually plausible, I guess. Mm-hmm. and it certainly has had a lot of adherence, including a number of people in Washington, D.C., who've been very famously fans of muscle confusion, a number of politicians. And so this group decided for the first time to actually see whether if you had people lifting the same amount of weight, whether they would get more, whether they would get stronger and more muscle mass by mixing up their routines every single time. And so they took a group of young men who were already experienced at weight training. And that was partly because they didn't want to have to teach people all of these exercises. Plus, people will respond very differently at the start of a weight training routine as opposed to if they've been doing it for a while. So they took these young, already fit men and brought them into the gym, and half of them did the same routine every single time, a good basic weight training routine, upper body, lower body, pretty standard exercises, and they did the exact same workout every single time, three times a week for 2 months. The other group lifted the same amount of weight, the weight that was not changed in terms of how much they were lifting, but their routines changed every single time. They had a specially designed app that included 80 different exercises that you could do to lift for your upper body and lower body. Mm-hmm. And the app would just randomly assign them and say, this is what you're doing today. And so those men for 2 months had a different routine every single time. And then they were tested at the beginning and at the end in terms of how large their muscle was and how strong it was, both the upper body and the lower body. So 2 months later, they were tested again, and it turned out there was virtually no difference at all mm-hmm. in terms of who had become stronger or whose muscles had grown most. And in fact, there was a very slight greater improvement in the group that had done the exact same routine every single time. But the big but is they also, and one of the researchers told me this was almost a last-minute addition to the study. They had asked the men at the beginning and again at the end to fill out a questionnaire about, in effect, how they felt about this workout. Was it motivating to them? Did they expect that they would keep doing it when the study ended? And it turned out that the group whose muscles were being confused, who were changing their routine all the time, reported much greater motivation. Mm-hmm. They said they were enjoying and expected to stick with the routine at a much higher rate than the group that were doing the same thing every single time. So the upshot of that would seem to be you actually cannot confuse a muscle. It knows exactly how much weight you are lifting, and it responds to the amount of weight you're lifting, however you happen to be lifting it. So you can mix it up all you want. You are probably not going to get a greater gain in strength and muscle mass. Mm-hmm. But your mind is not a muscle. And it in this group of young men who already were going to the gym, they reported that they were having, in effect, they were enjoying the switched up routines a lot more than the group that was doing the same thing all the time.
And therefore more likely to stick with it, which is which you and I have talked about so many times now, that it's great to start something. Can you keep it up?
Exactly. And that certainly is a real issue that you have to, I mean, everyone who's made all of their January resolutions, February tends to be the big quit the resolutions month. And it's often because people say, I wasn't having fun. I didn't enjoy it. And they stop. And in this case, among this group of men, and I do want to emphasize that, these were people who already were familiar with the gym and with mm-hmm. exercises. And for them, it was much more fun, or it looks like it was much more fun to switch things up a lot.
I think, too, there are a couple different elements about this I wanted to talk with you about. One was the idea that they already understood how to use the weights. You know, so often, I'm sure you've seen it, we all see it, you know, you see people misusing the exercise. They're doing it wrong. And it kind of drives me insane, but it's not considered good etiquette to, you know, tell a total stranger they're doing it wrong. That makes a big difference, though, doesn't it?
It does. And that's one of the points about this study that I would really emphasize. There are a couple of points to this. One is I don't worry about my muscles being confused in the gym, but I worry about me being confused in the gym. I'm not sure that I would know how to do 80 different exercises or that I would trust myself to do 80. And in fact, that sounds to me intimidating and unmotivating. Huh. I think if someone is interested in starting a gym program, it's a really good idea, and this answers to some degree your question, mm-hmm. make sure that you schedule at least one session with, presumably the gym has trainers who are affiliated with it.
Right.
Otherwise, ask your friends who they work with. You do need someone who will show you how to use these machines correctly, because you can obviously hurt yourself pretty easily if you have a recipe of 80 exercises that you suddenly are asked to do. Mm-hmm. It also may be that for some people, we really don't understand exercise behavior, and that's the biggest element right now, I think, in exercise science is trying to understand why, when every single person out there knows, we know this, I know it, you know it, that we should be moving more, mm-hmm. and we're not.
Mm-hmm.
And no one understands why that is true. And so a study like this, which suggests that variety may be really important in motivating people, mm-hmm. is almost certainly true for a lot of people and may not be true for everyone. Some people may actually turn out to love doing the exact same thing every time because they get better at it, and that may be motivating for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I would suggest to people that consider yourself. Be honest with yourself. I read this study, thought it was really interesting. I do think variety is really important. I'm not going to change my gym routine one bit because I know how to do what I do. I feel comfortable with it. I can see that I'm getting stronger as I do it, and that gives me motivation.
Mm-hmm. And for me, it's the boot camp I go to. They change up the routine every single day. It's different,
and they so have very confused muscles.
And they have exactly. I have super confused. Well, it just goes with the whole makeup, but and they have great trainers who are always talking about how to do it right and always,
right.
Really, really focused on getting people to do each movement, whatever that might be, correctly.
And I also
so I don't get irritated.
Exactly. And there's another element to this which plays into the behavioral side far more than the sort of physiological side, which is for some people the allure of even going to the gym involves the social aspect. They may want to do it with someone else far more than doing it themselves. And so to some degree, when people are planning what kind of workout they want to do, it really does require at least some self-reflection. Do you prefer to work out by yourself? And if you don't know, try. Do one by yourself.
Try different things.
Invite two of your friends.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Go to a class. See if you prefer that. Because it really is in the long term. And every study of exercise behavior, including this one at BASE, says you will stick with the workout that you like.
That's the one that works. Yeah.
Exactly. And in this case, it looks like, at least for this group, changing up the routine made it much more enjoyable. And if you are that kind of person, that's fabulous. Change it up all you want. Find one of the programs that promotes muscle confusion. You won't lose from that. You will get the same benefit in terms of how much strength you gain. But if you like it and will keep with it, it'll change your life.
You know, another thing about this study, though, and you and I have talked about this before, once again, it's white male, or I shouldn't say white males. I have no idea what color they are, but it's males.
They were Caucasian, young.
Yeah, I mean, and even the age doesn't bother me so much as, I don't know, women and men are different.
Yes, women and men are quite different, and I also do think the age does matter because young people are different than older people, and particularly older people who are starting a new program, it can be very intimidating. And in that case, it might well be that finding three or four exercises that you are comfortable doing in the gym is all you need. Maybe what you really want from a gym workout is to get in and out really fast. A study that I wrote about last year, and it was by some of these same researchers, found that especially in older people, you can do just one set. That means, you see all these young people who are doing three sets of 12 exercises at 70% of 1 RM and all these very complicated formulas.
Mm-hmm.
But it turned out you could do five, six repetitions of one exercise, like pulling the bar down, and if you did it till your arms were tired, that's all you needed to do. You got, particularly for older people who were starting a gym routine, they saw enormous gains in strength and in muscle mass. You don't have to do, if you don't want to, these complicated multi-part exercise routines in the gym. Ask a trainer to show you a simple program that will work your upper body and your lower body. You can probably do six exercises total. In this case, people were in and out of the gym in 13 minutes, and they saw really substantial gains in the strength and the amount of muscle mass that they had. So find a routine that works for you, that you like. If you like variety, change it up all the time. You can find a lot of apps now that will give you series of exercises that you can do. If you don't want to do that, do six and be in and out as fast as you can.
But one of the things you mentioned, and I know I have to let you go, but the idea of doing it until you're tired, that's the idea, is to get to the tired thing.
Yes, they call it to exhaustion, but you don't have to go that far. They even say to failure. It should just make you tired. And you know, we all know whether in fact we are pushing ourselves enough to benefit. And if you're honest with yourself, you always know that. And you can do that really quickly in the gym. So find a good trainer who can work your, show you how to use the machines, if that's how you want to do it. Join a class. Find the thing that you enjoy and will stick with, and it'll make 2020 a much healthier year.
Gretchen Reynolds, thank you so much for your time. I always appreciate having you on the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate being here.
Gretchen Reynolds is a columnist for the New York Times Well blog. We'll post a link to her blog on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
StoryCorps shares unscripted conversations between two people about important things in life: love, loss, family, friendship. StoryCorps partnered with WOSU Public Media to record and share the stories of our city. Recorded here, StoryCorps Columbus preserves pieces of our shared history for future generations. Subscribe to the StoryCorps Columbus podcast now at WOSU.org/StoryCorps, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Healthcare workers are the victims in 3 out of 4 workplace assaults, according to the Occupational Health and Safety Administration. To address the problem, the OSU Wexner Medical Center has trained a team of nurses to de-escalate violent situations. One of those nurses is Kristen Four. She is a psychiatric nurse. Welcome to the show.
Nice.
Also with us is Brian Eddy. He's a psychiatric care technician who is also on the team. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
All right. So let's talk about who's initiating these violent episodes. What do we know about who that is?
Generally, it's patients in all areas of the hospital. We don't see it really in one area more particular than any others. When we first started, we got a lot of, oh, we don't care for psych patients here. Oh, we probably won't see you much.
Right.
Well, you don't have to have a psychiatric diagnosis to be in crisis. So we go all over, and a lot of times it's just patients in distress, whether it be from getting difficult news or maybe they really have a psychiatric illness that's very acute right now.
And maybe not part of why they're in the hospital.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
It could be surgery-related delirium where they're coming out of anesthesia.
I just say stupid stuff when I've come out of anesthesia, but I can imagine there's a lot of confusion and stuff like that when you're first waking up. It's a horrible feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And is it just patients, though, who are the problem?
I would say no. We do a lot of debriefing with staff, too. There are times where we've gone to calls and we've noticed a pattern that maybe the patient wasn't the primary concern, that maybe that nurse, the way that they're maybe saying something, or maybe they are having some countertransference and they're seeing this patient that's in distress and it's reminding them of their mom or their grandma. And maybe they didn't have a good relationship with that person. So then they're getting very defensive. And our job at that point is kind of to de-escalate the staff member. And we've had times where we've been called for staff members who just received horrible news that a family member died. And so they're kind of in shock. They don't know what to do. And the staff call us.
And here they're in this kind of a position where they have to treat other people.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so let's talk about de-escalating and what that means. It's been, this program has been going. It's called the Behavioral Emergency Response Team. Yep. And first of all, tell me how it works. It's a team of people. How many?
There's 8 of us total.
And is it the particular 8 who's one way or another is going to be on duty at any given time?
Yeah, so we try to have 2-3 people together on the clock at the same time. Generally, we'll have a gap in the beginning of from 7 to 11 in the morning or 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. The hours we serve are 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. every single day. So sometimes we'll have a little bit of gap where you might be alone, might only be one person there. But generally, it is better to have multiple.
And how many calls are you getting for this, Brian?
We're averaging.
now that they know you're there, right?
Yeah, 2019, which was. So we started February 12th of last year. So February 12th to December 31st, we had 1,585 calls.
And what used to happen before that, Brian?
We were the step between nursing and security. So up until that point, if nursing felt it was out of their realm, they would call security. And security is trained in de-escalation,
sure,
but not as extensively. We are definitely not in dealing with diagnoses that we've dealt with. It's just they're more situationally based. So we've become a large resource for the nursing staff and throughout the hospital. So we're actually even rounding in the Harding Hospital, which is a psychiatric unit as well.
Uh-huh.
So we're actually providing help to the psychiatric care units as well as the rest of the hospital.
It sounds like it was an unmet need then before.
Absolutely.
And it also sounds like it might have been something people didn't even realize was a need until they knew there was a resource.
Yep. We still to this day, we'll get calls and we'll say, hey, you know, what exactly do you guys do?
We're still educating as we go.
Yeah. What are the most common questions?
What is it you do? How long does it take you to get here? That's usually the big one. It's like,
yeah,
what's your response?
What good are you if you're coming an hour later?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And depending on, there are times where we're at other calls and we have to split up. So we have to be able to work autonomously as well. So being able to go in cold and figure out what's going on with the patients and kind of work them backwards from where they are. I mean, it's situationally based. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. And we're talking about a response by the OSU Wexner Medical Center to the issue of a report, according to the Government Accountability Office, between 2009 and 2013, healthcare professionals reported more than 730,000 cases of assault. OSHA says the violence is likely vastly underreported, and the violence is on all different. I'm sure it's a continuum that you're getting calls for. There's not, you know, something really horrific happening every time somebody calls you. They're calling you before it becomes bad, I guess is the idea. My guests are Brian Eddy. He's a psychiatric care technician at Ohio State, and also Kristen Forrest. She's a psychiatric nurse at Ohio State's Wexner Medical Center, and they're on the OSU Wexner Medical Center's Behavioral Emergency Response Team that they've developed and that got started last year in February. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. It sounds to me like something that's so that intermediate role, because it avoids having to go all the way to what we think of as security, right? And that's good, right?
That's
a hospital setting.
Yeah, that is the goal. I mean, there are times where absolutely it's needed. There are times where we call security when we're up there. It's out of our hands, or maybe even sometimes a security presence is all that's needed. Other times that's what sets off patients. They see somebody, an officer in a uniform, and they're, you called the cops on me. They're freaking out, and it's worse, and we're in a bigger problem.
How do you guys, I mean, you also have your own jobs, right?
This is our sole
job.
This
is your job now.
This is a full-time job. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So what does that feel like, leaving what you used to do and doing this full-time?
I often say if a group of people went into a room and tried to develop a job for me, this is what they'd have walked out of the room with.
Did you ask to be on this team?
I actually left a position with a residential care facility in town to come back to OSU to work on this team.
And what attracted you to it?
I liked the idea that I could work autonomously, I would still also be a trainer of crisis de-escalation skills when I came back, but also that It's never the same day twice. You're not on the same unit. You're not with the same group of patients.
Right.
I may have a group of patients that are very familiar to me or to us as a group that we round on daily. But when you're responding to calls, sometimes it's that group of patients. A lot of times it's just someone you've never met before.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Kristen?
I love it. I think it's absolutely
perfect
fit for me.
Were you recruited to do it?
I was at Riverside Methodist Hospital in their inpatient psychiatric unit. I was working there, and I tampered with the idea of coming to OSU and went back and forth. And when I saw the posting for this position, I had done a little bit of research and saw some out-of-state hospitals that had implemented something similar. And I was like, well, if that's what I think it is, that would be amazing.
And has it been?
It's been, I love it. Like you said, it's every single day is different. Every situation is different. It never gets old. I like being able to think on my toes. And it really allows you to be creative. There are times where we get calls and one person might not know exactly what to do, or the staff up there don't know what to do. And we have to think outside of the box, what's going to work for this patient right now to calm them down. And we've done all kinds of creative things that just on a whim like that.
Give me an example of that. What you mean by that?
Let's see. So, we developed a behavioral plan for a patient who was a long-term patient. So he had to be there for a very long time. He was awaiting placement, couldn't walk. He had a stroke. It was very sad scenario. Didn't have much support. We were actually probably one of the only consistencies in his care because he had been throughout so many different parts of the hospital.
Okay.
So we were the consistent face. We worked with the physicians to develop a plan where they allowed us to take him to the little cafe inside the James. It's on the 12th floor, so you get a little fresh air, but it is enclosed.
Yeah.
So it's nice for the patients to get a little fresh air, but it's meant for more of family members and coffee and stuff like that. But we would take him there once a day and get some fresh air, get some coffee, play some cards.
Helped him decompress a little bit?
Absolutely.
To avoid.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's really nice. You're not waiting then until there's a crisis.
No,
right.
It's a very proactive team. With the patients we round, our longer term patients we round with, we're always trying to work out what's going on today, what can help you be better today.
And with the staff, are they welcoming as well?
I ask
that because now I realize, well, you might be helping staff help subdue staff in some cases.
Mm-hmm. They are, when we first started going around and doing our education on here's what we're going to be doing, here's when you should call us, to a person, they were like, well, you need an office on this floor. I mean, it was like every unit was saying,
everybody wants their own IT, and now everybody wants their own.
And so the response we get within the hospital has been tremendous. I mean, they're very supportive. There was a lot of second guessing from some.
Uh-huh.
They're like, no, we need to call those guys. So they actually now, instead of just when we come in and go hands off, they kind of want to kind of tag along. What's going on? How can I learn from you guys? What's a better approach here?
All the better, right?
Mm-hmm. And
you encourage that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Let's see. Carol in Dublin, you're on the air. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that 2 years ago, I had an emergency appendectomy at OSU. And I had to be given Narcan after the anesthesia. So I woke up with no pain medicine on board. And then they tried it, were trying different pain medicine. And it was just sort of a hot mess. And the medication I was given just really affected me adversely. And I was hallucinating and agitated and combative and paranoid and, And so it went downhill fast. My family was trying to advocate for me. And the nursing staff was really, they didn't know how to handle it. Honestly, I didn't feel like they knew how to handle it. And when the doctor finally came in to say, who the surgeon was great, he came in and said, do you want to leave? And I said, yes. I was actually hallucinating at the time. I remember the whole scene. And I was in no shape to go home. I ended up with lots of complications. So I was in the hospital three times within 10 days with these complications. But the nursing staff, they sort of became... The countertransference really struck a chord because, I just felt like they were sort of acting out with me instead of de-escalating me.
Huh.
And my point is I could have really used this team, and I'm sure they could have too.
Okay.
There's an episode in Seinfeld where Elaine becomes the bad patient. She's labeled the bad patient, and that's kind of what happened to me. So I'm thrilled to hear. I'm thrilled to hear that you guys are doing this. I'm sure you stay very busy.
It sounds like such a healthy thing to do. Carol, thanks a lot. How many of you are there? Did it say eight?
There's eight.
Total of eight, yeah.
And everybody wants one on their own floor. And is the university thinking about expanding this? Because it's a big place. And it's not just the hospital. There's all, most people at the hospital aren't staying at the hospital. They're there for appointments where they're going to leave. Mm-hmm.
So the talk now about expansion is to, within the hospital, would be ambulatory outpatient services and possibly by spring or some, the conversation is going to move towards OSU East. Do we develop a team for OSU East, and how do we go about doing that? But that's well above my pay grade.
And then I'm wondering about family members, if that becomes an issue too. They're advocating, and sometimes they can get more agitated than the patient. They're kind of externalized, and they're outside of what's going on. Is that an issue too?
We've had a handful of calls about family members, and generally from a safety standpoint, we will refer to security just because they're not a patient inside the hospital. We would be afraid if
it's
we had
different.
To go hands-on or something. There's a whole legal issue there.
But
that being said, we have gone to calls, and we primarily focus on the patient and the family members there and working together. We can come up with some type of solution to whatever issue is going on. And there have been times where we've been called by security for a family member that they're not sure what to do with. Like, they're not acting out, they're not violent, but he seems really confused. He's, I think he needs to go to the emergency room, but he's really afraid of us. Can you guys come talk to him?
That's nice.
Okay, we'll go in together, and we work more as a team with them too. So it's been very collaborative in nature.
Yeah, it's been very, probably our most difficult thing early on was not saying no. I mean, we had mandates of just patients and just this section of the hospital, and it's difficult to say no, because they're, this person calling you is, we need help with this person in crisis. So
how often is this an emergency room issue?
Very rare, actually.
Okay, I was going to say a lot of people think maybe particularly with the opioid crisis and people struggling with addiction and that kind of a thing, it might be more.
Well, you'll see that on the inpatient units a lot. Medical units are there all the time, especially the Heart Hospital. The Ross Heart sees a lot of that with endocarditis. And but in general, the ED doesn't call us as frequently as we wish they would. But they have security right near them.
Yeah.
So it is
it's
quicker.
It's a different setup.
Yeah, it's quicker. If they're in an emergency or they need to de-escalate somebody, it's a lot quicker to call security compared to us coming from a whole different part of the hospital, from our office or wherever we're at, to meet them there. So I think it's just a set of mind that they've kind of been used to that and programmed that way for years. So we're trying to get them converted to our way, though.
Well, so you proselytize as well.
We try.
There's so many times we actually go to a call where one of us will be handling the call and the other one's providing education for what we do.
Okay.
Because it's either we have...
You're kind of tag teaming it.
Right. Yeah. We have new employees are coming in, and so they need that information as well.
Mm-hmm. And how do you... what do you think has been the most valuable part of your training? What taught you the most to deal with what you're actually coming in contact with?
You've been doing this a lot longer than me, so.
Yeah, over my 30 years is to know that the one thing I've learned is that no matter how upset someone is, it can't last. Mm-hmm. You can't operate the car in the red for only so long. This will pass. It's just a matter of how do I help make it pass a little quicker. I may be the person who's actually helping to keep it escalated, so I need to be smart enough to go, hey, Kristen, you give this a shot, or step back and figuring out who's the target right now or what's the target and kind of going after that.
And I think that's the whole part of thinking on your feet, and just it all depends on where your head's at the moment. I mean, it's this, the ultimate human interaction. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're dealing with people when they're sick, they're at their weakest. People and I, we hear about the burnout rate among staff at hospitals. I'm wondering if this might help at least a little bit. Help ease some of that pain they suffer.
We're hoping. Before we started, I sent out a survey to the staff, just kind of gauging their comfort level with caring for psychiatric patients and their resilience overall. And we're looking to get the results for the one-year implementation survey. We'll see how that goes. But
yeah.
We also joke that this is the one job that when we show up, people are like, oh, Thank goodness. Bird is here.
Right. Imagine nice. Working in a place where everybody's happy to see you.
Yeah.
That's never happened before.
Yeah. Even sometimes when we don't even feel like we've done anything, and we're like, you know, we just kind of sat with him for 30 minutes and let her vent, and then we left. They're like, no, thank you, because they don't generally have the time for that. They're pulled
exactly.
in so many different directions. So,
let's see. I want to get this call. Paul in Mount Vernon, you're on the air. Hi, Paul.
Good morning. I could have used this team. My wife was in the hospital. My wife is very, very timid, and she wants to please everybody. And she was in the hospital. She was very sick, and a nurse made a decision to give her some medication for her pain that the doctor, her primary doctor specifically said she couldn't have, and it was bad for her. So I told the nurse that, and the nurse got a little argumentative, and I did too. And in addition to that, the doctor, this was the same situation, but later on, the doctor made a very odd comment about insurance. And I just thought that was really not the place to do it while she's in bed, very, very sick. And so I got upset. I didn't yell. I explained to her what my feelings were. And it didn't work out very well. And
yeah.
But I think that a team like this, and of course everybody loves OSU, I think a team like this, this was at my local hospital in Mount Vernon, but I think a team like this would help tremendously in any hospital, small or big.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah. Paul, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We ran out of time. I have to let you go, but thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it. Kristen Foer is a psychiatric nurse at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center, and Brian Eddy is a psychiatric care technician at the same place, and they're both members of the 8-person unit known as the Behavioral Emergency Response Team at the hospital, help de-escalate potentially violent or violent situations at the hospital. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. About 1.7 million Americans develop sepsis. That's an out-of-control immune response to infection that can lead to tissue damage, organ failure, and death. And about 270,000 people die from it each year, making it the leading cause of death in hospitals. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control. Ohio State researchers believe they found a way to boost immune cells' ability to fight off the underlying infection, which could lead to a better sepsis treatment. Their work was published earlier this month in Nature Nanotechnology. Icho Dong is an associate professor at the College of Pharmacy at Ohio State and a senior author of the study. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And Sonal Panu is a pulmonologist and critical care specialist working at the OSU Wexner Medical Center. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So this study was published earlier this month in Nature Nanotechnology suggests that nanotechnology has something to do with what you're studying. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so in this study, we are focusing on the late-stage sepsis. So
late-stage sepsis.
Yes.
Okay.
Clinical data show more than 60% sepsis patients survive through the initial septic shock.
Okay.
But they quickly progress into a longer immunosuppressive state. And at this state, patients have low number of immune cells, leading to inability to clear higher chance of the secondary infections and a high mortality rate. Therefore, our study are focusing on developing a new strategy to treat this late-stage sepsis or sepsis with immunosuppression.
Which is costing the most lives.
Yes.
Okay. So if it's early-stage sepsis and you catch it, you can treat it, usually.
Yes. So, you know, the biggest barrier with sepsis is recognition and identification.
Okay.
Once we get to that, we act fast, fast, fast. And our first goal is control the sepsis. So control the source, which is the infection causing the sepsis. So we go antibiotics, we go broad spectrum antibiotics. We give patients IV fluids to help with the dehydration. And if they progress to further the next stage of sepsis, I would say, is septic shock. When you're hurt and your blood vessels are affected and you can't maintain
That's where it's going after the tissue and the organs at that point.
Yes, that's one of the other organs that sepsis has affected.
And all right, so Dr. Dong, what is the role of nanotechnology in all of this?
So in this study, we integrate nanotechnology and cell therapy together to treat multi-drug-resistant bacterial sepsis. So when we design this nanotechnology or new therapeutics, we try to learn from nature. So vitamins are natural components for a lot of cell function, cell processes.
Vitamin D from the sun.
Yeah, all kinds of vitamins. Yeah. So also chemically, these vitamins, they possess very unique and very diverse functional groups. So we think we can incorporate these vitamin components into our nanoparticles. And meanwhile, we can design antimicrobial agents for these vitamin-derived nanoparticles. And then these vitamin-derived nanoparticles equip macrophages, that's one type of white blood cells, with potent antimicrobial activity.
Okay, so you're taking white blood cells and you're putting these nano vitamins into them.
Yes.
Okay.
And with that, this cell-based therapy can help with sepsis models with immunosuppression.
And you're focusing on late stage, just to remind our listeners, because that's when it takes the most lives. That's if it gets that far, that's where your resources are falling short.
Right. When we get to late stage sepsis, our treatment is focused on support, advanced organ support, but that's all we have. Our bacteria are getting tougher than our strongest antibiotics, so we have to look for newer stages.
Right, and so this isn't a new problem. It's been an evolving or devolving problem, I guess, depending on your point of view. Sepsis is getting worse because the treatments are less effective, the conventional treatments.
Exactly, especially for the late stage sepsis. Yeah.
In your study, you focused on mice with sepsis.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So in our study, our results prove the concept that this nanoparticle-enabled macrophage transfer can significantly improve survival rate in the sepsis mice with immunosuppression. And these macrophages can recover the innate immune defense, eliminate multi-drug-resistant bacterial, and also restore body functions in these preclinical models.
So it can then, when you say eliminate the resistance to the broad-spectrum antibiotics, that's a huge deal.
It absolutely is. We're very excited for Dr. Dong's research.
Because that means you don't have to just keep pumping in you can start working backwards again.
Correct. And it's a newer method of delivery of antibiotics within the cell.
Less invasive?
Possibly.
I mean, is that an idea there? Or
for human, I think later clinical trials, we need to figure out what's the best administration route.
Okay.
But right now, it's a proof of concept in mouse studies.
How do you administer it to the mice?
So that depends on the infection site.
Okay.
So if it's an intravenous infection of the bacterial, then we need to do intravenous administration of the cells. Then they can help clear the bacteria in the blood and the major organs.
I always think of sepsis, of course, when I think of sepsis, I think of it as a blood-borne problem, not something that has anything much to do with the site of the infection. So I cut my hand, that's the site of infection, but after that, does it matter that much?
It does. So it can be a specific site of infection, and then your body responds because your immunity is trying to control that infection, and then it goes in an overdrive state, which then affects your other organ system.
And ultimately, you still have to deal with the origin.
Yes, absolutely. That is the source. That's where you control it.
And are there ways that people are more likely to develop sepsis depending on what kind of infection site we're talking about? So if the infection is internal or external, does it matter necessarily?
I think that doesn't necessarily matter as much as the person, you know, the immunity, the state of immunity the person has. So if you have lowered immunity, like if you have cancer or chemotherapy, that's when you're likely to be affected more than a person who has normal immunity, although both can be.
And then another issue, why is it hard to detect early stage sepsis? What is it about that? And, you know,
because it presents in a very generalized manner.
Okay. I'm feeling tired today.
Yes. Yeah, so okay. It can happen to anybody. And it can happen, it's, you know, respective of age and gender. So if you don't mind, can I give your example? Say you have a chest cold today and you might feel crummy for a few days and get back to work, or you might get worse and start breathing really fast and you went to the emergency room, they put oxygen on you. Then we say, oh, you're breathing even faster and you're not doing that good today. We need to put you on a ventilator, take you to the ICU, give you antibiotics. So you progress from what was an infection to sepsis.
Okay.
And if your blood pressure then fails, then we'll call it septic shock.
That kind of reminds me of the time I called the nurse at my doctor's office and said, I'm really having a hard time. I feel like I have a rubber band around my neck and I'm having a hard time breathing. And she goes, okay, we'll get you in at one. And I said, well, I don't have time to come in. She goes, you're having a hard time breathing. So a lot of it just goes to people being ignorant about their own bodies and what they need to be aware of.
Yes, I would say we absolutely need to be aware of sepsis because that's step one. Every minute is important.
What's the difference between early stage sepsis and just the cold? How do you know? Can you test for it?
There are some methods that we test of how your body is responding to infection.
Okay.
You know, your white blood count is the one to begin with, but there are things like lactic acid and other methods that we're looking at, procalcitonin and so. So some of them are specific and strong. Some of them are general. So we're making our way to understand who's developing sepsis and who's not.
So Professor Dong, what's the next step now?
So now we are working together with clinicians like Dr. Panu at OSU College of Medicine and also clinicians at Nationwide Children's Hospital on the realization of this cell-based therapy for the clinic. And next, we would need to establish a process for large-scale production of these cells. And also, we would need to work together with FDA to initiate a clinical trial.
A human for the, clinical trial.
Yes, human clinical trial for the right patient population. And we really hope this cell-based therapy can provide a more effective treatment for the sepsis patients.
When you do a human clinical trial, that would have to be almost nationwide, wouldn't it, to have the right number of, or not?
It doesn't have to be. We can do that locally, or we can collaborate with multiple medical centers.
Yeah.
The details of that would have to come with knowing what effects we're looking at.
Would you only be able to study, though, in people that have sepsis, or can you study it in people who don't have sepsis? Does that make sense?
For phase one clinical trial, we can do both because that's mainly for the safety test. We can either do sepsis patients or house people, house volunteers.
Okay.
For the phase two or phase three clinical trials, we will need patients, the right patient population with sepsis, especially in this case for the late stage sepsis.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us. Ijo Dong is an associate professor at The Ohio State University College of Pharmacy. Congratulations on your research and best wishes for every success going forward.
Thank you so much.
And Sonal Panu is a pulmonologist and critical care specialist at The Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center. She's an assistant professor at The Ohio State College of Medicine. Thanks to you as well, and good
luck. Thank you, Anne. This was great.
You bet. Listen, you be sure to like All Sides on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.